What's up, everybody? You're listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGN Plus, your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. And it's time for one of my favorite things to do, which is the No Coast Board of Review. I'm your board chairman, Tom Hush, and joining me is one of our esteemed board members, Mr. Matt Cipolla. He is a fantastic film critic, one of the best young film critics out there, and a very good friend of the show. Matt, thanks so much for joining us again.
Hi, yeah, yeah.
So we've got a lot to talk about. I think I have to say, as a month in general, September, not too bad. I was especially after our conversation about August, which I thought was really I listened back to it and I'm just like, wow, we had very little good to say about what was happening in August. I think September was pretty good. Would you agree?
Yeah, it was, I mean, it was about what you'd expect, if not better. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I feel like we're in this period of time where we're waiting to get to the prestige films. You know, we've got A Star Is Born opening this week, mm-hmm. And it's already experiencing rave reviews. First Man is also coming this month. And on the genre side for the horror fans, we've got the Halloween soft reboot kind of retcon from David Gordon Green, one of the most interesting filmmakers or in terms of career and what he's done, one of the most interesting filmmakers working right now. But let's look at September. There were some movies that I really had high hopes for and I thought were going to be good. But let's start off with one that I thought was truly the definition of unnecessary and an example. I think the only better example of the only better case against connected film universes is maybe Tom Cruise's The Mummy. This comes very close after that. Like, this whole idea of cinematic universes that Marvel brought to us is really running awry in terms of quality. Obviously, the film we're going to talk about here is part of an extremely successful horror franchise. Of course, we're talking about The Nun, which is the latest entry in the Conjuring cinematic universe. Are you a fan of the Conjuring movies? Or even if not a fan, like, what are your feelings on that whole franchise?
I liked the first two main films. I think those are the only ones I saw. I didn't see either Annabelle, and those are the only ones there so far, right? Yeah, I haven't seen any of the other two spinoff films so far. I really liked the first one. I thought the second one was also solid. That was about the extent of that. They were just effective and not a ton more than that, but I enjoyed them.
Mm-hmm. I'd have to agree with at least the main Conjuring films. So Conjuring 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. I think they're decent. They're of a style that I don't particularly enjoy when it comes to horror. Although, as the great music and film critic Tom Brayan has said before, respect motherfucking craft. I have to give it up for, as James Wan, correct, who did both.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to respect what he's accomplished. I think they're, as you said, effective. Just not particularly for me. I have to really put myself in the whole, like, okay, so, you know, put myself in the shoes of the average moviegoer who doesn't have an obsession with, like, more obscure classics like Suspiria or, like, I don't know, and literally any other horror movie other than this kind of pop horror that's come out of, I would say, starting with Paranormal Activity. Like, that's some real pop horror.
Sure.
Stuff that people are just like, oh, I'm going to get so scared. Oh, I can't. Oh, no. So you said this is the first of the spinoff films from The Conjuring that you've seen. The yeah. other two being Annabelle and Annabelle Creation.
Yeah.
Both of which I was just like, why? I wasn't, there was no real interest for me. I was like, I don't really need to know why these things exist. It kind of goes against the horror element for me. Like, yeah. how did that work for you with The Nun?
I mean, it was, that was the main thing. It was such a the whole thing was just such a reach. I mean, you have a peripheral character from the second film that is essentially being shoehorned into its own feature as a main antagonist. And so you have to craft and retcon this entire mythology that is increasingly contrived and no one cares. I don't see the point of it other than trying to squeeze out a few hundred million, which they did successfully because globally it's now the most successful film in the franchise, but it's so hollow and it's boring. And it's when it's not boring, it's kind of maddening in terms of how it tries to mash together really odd comic relief. And it's quite short. I think it's around an hour and a half, but it feels way longer. But it's even the sort of stuff that you would at least expect from this franchise or films of this ilk don't really play out. Like there's some very inconsistent makeup effects that look really shoddy. There are some really, really odd choices in the visual effects, both in terms of when they chose to use visual effects. And then also some of those effects seem really under rendered. And then it all just sort of boils together into a stew that by the time it concludes, I don't know if I would say it's incoherent because that implies that there is some sort of main narrative, whereas anything here just sort of, it exists, I guess.
Yeah.
Barely, but it's there.
It's a total, it's that pop horror, just like really ramping up the marketing and making you, I would almost say that with a movie like The Nun, they have to convince you it's scary before you even go in.
Yeah.
Because it's not actually scary. It's surprising insofar as it has jump scares and there's like some, you know, like, everybody loves religious iconography when it comes to horror because it does, you know, it does something to our brain. And, I mean, I think hands down the scariest movie ever made, which is The Exorcist, in my opinion, scariest movie ever made. Part of that comes from the subversion or rather the perversion of religious iconography. That's part of the horror. So, right. You know, they're hitting the marks there. They're just like, oh yeah, no, we got to have an upside down cross. People will be like, oh no. Like, but I find it interesting that you also picked up on the effects, because a lot of great horror lives and dies by its effects. And I feel like horror has always been a genre where people who work in makeup and, you know, kind of design those artistic nuts and bolts of making the movie look a certain way is where they get to shine. You get some of the biggest names in special effects, your Stan Winstons, your guys like that, who all came up through horror because they were just like, hey, we have to make something that doesn't actually exist, and it needs to be frightening, and it needs to play on all these fears. And as you said, The Nun's effects are, when they're CG, they're under-rendered. They look so fake. And when it comes to the makeup, it's, again, as you said, inconsistent. And it seems just totally off. It seems like they really just pushed this one out, which is sad. I want to say the Conjuring films are Blumhouse, correct?
New Line.
Oh, they're New Line. Okay, never mind. Because, yeah. I mean... Blumhouse has pushed out some real stinkers before, but like this is just franchise horror, and this makes me think of the real nadir of like the Halloween franchise, Friday the 13th, you know, the Nightmare on Elm Street. When you get to this point where the genre is just so played out, like when this like slasher film comes in and it's like a huge revelation, like when the birth of the slasher with Halloween in 1978 reinvigorates horror, and then it just totally runs itself into the ground. And I feel like that's where we're getting with paranormal horror, like this 2000s paranormal horror, which I guess you could kind of trace back all the way to something like the Blair Witch, I feel like a lot of these are very Blair Witch inspired in a sense with the way that they treat jumps and the building of tension, but nowhere near as effectively as the Blair Witch Project. I don't know if that's if I'm talking out of my ass here.
Oh, no. That makes sense. I mean, the thing is, you can tell that these movies are not necessarily copying what the films of the early 2000s were inspired by. They're just copying the films of the early 2000s.
Yeah.
So there's like this, there's a law of diminishing returns, and just everything sort of like exponentially decreases as they copy it more and more and more. And that's to be expected, but I just, especially at this point in time where this boom of paranormal horror started, you're looking back, like the current state that we're in, this started 11 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's just, and I'm surprised we haven't reached, to be honest, I'm surprised we haven't reached the obligatory dive into self-aware horror for this subgenre by now.
Where's Scream?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm sure I'd be down for that, because I'm just always down for stuff like that. But I mean, it is something that has overstayed its welcome. I mean, I'll keep chugging along with it, just in the event that something awesome comes out. But
it's such a product of this kind of postmodern self-reference.
Yeah.
Because it's like you're just making movies out of throwaway shit. Like, Annabelle is like kind of creepy, and I mean, within the context of the original Conjuring, there's a bit of world building there. It seems to be a bit of a character moment when they introduce the idea of Annabelle and being like, "Hey, these characters have been at this for a while. They've seen some serious shit."
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't hate the idea of having these artifacts, because it builds out a little bit of Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga's characters and gives them this history, which builds their credibility for the current situation. You know, it's decent character building and world building, but it's like, do we really need to know how Annabelle got there? It's like, who the fuck cares? It's there. And it's this tendency for people to over-explain things, especially in this world where you can just make a movie out of like self-reference,
right.
And you know, prove that it's financially viable, especially through even like the Star, like Solo, A Star Wars Story, which I think is a movie that gets a bit over criticized. I think it's a perfectly decent movie, but its existence is fucked up by the fact that it's like, wait, you're telling me that you made an entire 2-hour feature out of one line in Star Wars from 1977. And it's just, oh, we made the Kessel Run in, you know, XYZ parsecs. And they made an entire movie about that, essentially.
Yeah.
Or Rogue One, which is like, oh yeah, this is how we got the Star Wars plans. I don't think people realize the idea of like, they see it as a loose thread, as like just a loose end of narrative, but it really isn't. It's just in of itself exists and is just merely a detail to build something out, but you don't need to go into it because it really doesn't matter. And as we've seen with all these different franchise spinoffs, whether it's Star Wars or The Conjuring or Marvel, like, you know, no one really gives a shit about the Inhumans. No one's going to watch the Inhumans on ABC because no one cares. It doesn't matter. But that's I really hated this movie. I think I've gotten back into using Letterboxd. I know you're like the king of Letterboxd, and I think I gave it like a 1 star. There's like maybe 2 or 3 movies that I've ever put logged onto Letterboxd that I've given 1 star, and this was just a legitimately total mess of a movie. I want to hop from one mess to another. The Predator.
Oh yeah.
Which really upsets me because, as listeners of the show know, Connor and I are huge Predator fans. I own all the Predator movies, even the Alien versus Predator ones. And there's just something about that franchise that I find to be like super endearing in every way. You know, the first one is a classic of the genre, really a staple of the idea of the 80s action movie, and of Arnold Schwarzenegger's career. You get Predator 2, which is just like very, it's so 90s, like it's very of its time, and it doesn't exactly reinvent the wheel, but I think is kind of a cult gem when it comes to sequels. Predators, which was Robert Rodriguez producing and Nimrod Antal. I could go on forever, but I've always found it to be an interesting franchise that people totally know and love, despite maybe never having seen any of those movies or only having seen like small bits of it. And so that's why they're still able to pump out a Predator movie roughly every 10 to 20 years, somewhere in that time frame, you can get a new Predator movie. This one is the shortest distance between a Predator movie. So Predators came out in 2010. This is 2018. So only 8 years, which is really very short for a franchise that's been operating since 1987. And this one written and directed by Shane Black, who was in the original Predator. He's a guy that I've always really respected when it comes to writing action films. He knows exactly what he's about. Problematic guy, very problematic guy. And even with this movie, you know, there's a lot of controversy surrounding it, regarding his casting of a friend who is a registered sex offender.
Yeah.
And, I take Shane Black usually about face value. Sure. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and The Nice Guys are two of my favorite like kind of sleeper hits of their respective years. Really well crafted genre crime movies, and really well written, very funny, well acted. This movie, I wanted to be good so bad. I was like, dude, let's bring the Predator back. Let's make this franchise viable again. And you saw it.
Yes, I did. And it could have used more Predator.
Yeah, right? For a movie called The Predator, there's like hardly any Predator.
The Predator with an article in front of it. It could have done that. The main thing is that it's just, it is, well, I mean, I guess it would help people in theory if they go into it knowing that it is first and foremost a wacky comedy with some action sequences, and that comedy is very grating, and it's not even so much like I could understand if it weren't my type of humor, but it's just every single actor is so at the mercy of the lines they have to deliver, and that brings some varying degrees of bleh to all the performances. I mean, Keegan-Michael Key is insufferable here just because of all the stuff he has to do is completely intolerable. He's just like he was giving me flashbacks to Mark Wahlberg in Mile 22. The thing is, it just seems so unaware of its own time in terms of its place in its own franchise, but also its place within modern cinema, because it's trying so hard to emulate that sort of like 80s macho, you know, self-aware, like corny humor, but it's also throwing in these bits of, you know, that sort of like mid to late 2010 internet edgelord sort of comedy. And it just feels very try hard. And the thing is, it's not self-aware. It actually thinks it's earnestly funny. It's not being ironically funny. It actually thinks that it's amiable. And I mean, there are a bunch of running gags that don't really go anywhere. They're just sort of there, surface level. I mean, everyone in the movie is essentially an archetype, which would be fine if that had a point. But they're not so much archetypes in that way. They're more stereotypes. And it all, you know, bleeds together into something where, you know, by the time you get to the third act, it doesn't make really much of any sense. And then you realize, oh, they had to reshoot this entire third act. I can tell.
Yeah, it's very rare that general audiences are able to tell when something has very clearly been changed.
Yeah.
And as the listeners know, I work in a movie theater and we carried The Predator, and there were so many people. We're a small movie theater, so we like to have conversations with the customers, especially our regulars when they come in and see a movie. And there were so many people that walked out of it that were just like, what happened in the last 30 minutes? Because it just seemed to become a completely different movie that didn't follow its own premise. Like, it just made zero sense. Like, and I'm not trying to call general movie going audiences stupid. They're not stupid. And studios think they're stupid.
Right. I mean, obviously they're not, because they can pick up on this, but the thing is, it feels like the last half hour or so becomes more of a fan fiction, but the thing is that fan fiction is now canon in how they've implemented it into the franchise, and it's there forever and ever and ever. But it's not too long. I think it's just shy of 2 hours. It feels a lot longer than that. It's very shoddily paced in terms of how it glues together all of its individual sequences. So there isn't much of a narrative flow. And on top of that, it just isn't a ton of fun. You can tell that they were kind of grasping at straws here. And it very much feels like a studio shadow of what Shane Black's sort of quick-witted, multifaceted banter is. But sort of like chewed up by a machine and then also edited into a bunch of pieces and then sewn back together.
Yeah. And I will say, I think I may have enjoyed it a little bit more than you did, mainly because I am such a stan for this franchise. And I mean, the humor was hit or miss for me. Like, there was definitely some of that grating shit, especially some of the lines that Keegan-Michael Key was fed. And yeah. You could just tell he was phoning it in. He's like, this is fucking stupid. This isn't funny. You're talking about one of the most celebrated comedians of the last, I don't know, 10 to 15 years with Key and Peele. Mm-hmm. And even going back farther to stuff like Mad TV, he's a guy, he knows comedy. He knows exactly what he's doing. And right. You could tell he was like, I can't believe you're making me tell this joke in 2018. Like, this is really stupid. But there was like some of the camaraderie and shit between the guys. I was like, there's these flashes of brilliance where I'm just like, oh man, this movie could have gone somewhere else. And we can speculate whether or not it was studio meddling or if it was Shane Black just losing his touch a little bit. It's really anybody's guess. But there were parts of it that I was like, okay, this is interesting. This, like, the scenario they're in is legitimately interesting. But as you said, there's just like, it's very sloppy. The pacing is all over the place. Olivia Munn's character is basically just there. Like, she gets introduced like she's going to be important, and then she's just whisked away like, nope, we don't care about what she has to do anymore.
Yeah, I felt so bad for her, because it's also like, going back to what I said about how all the actors, like, their performances end up being, you know, just completely reliant on what sort of stuff and things they have to say and do. Olivia Munn is easily the best part of the movie because she is the least obnoxious.
Yes.
But they also just, she's also just sort of like a punching bag for all sorts of, you know, inconsequential jokes. And it also goes back to that sort of like faux edgy humor of like, they just try really hard to make her kind of like the hot girl, but like, she's the hot girl who also like has a degree in biology
and can fire a gun.
Yeah, that. And it's also, I mean, it, like, that sort of humor also extends itself. There's like a weird streak in terms of how this movie treats people with any sort of like mental illness or disorder. God. There's one character who has a very, very comical, in air quotes, like type of Tourette's, and all he'll do is just sort of like spout off obscenities. It's mostly an excuse for him to verbally harass Olivia Munn's character, and then other people to be like, oh, it's okay, he can't help it. And then like Jacob Tremblay from Room, the little kid from Room, is the main character's son. He's this savant on the spectrum who somehow summons the Predator from an alien artifact in his basement. That's also sort of out of touch and out of its depth.
I really want to dig into this because it was one of my main problems with the story main problems with the characters and a little bit of the story, the way that starts to play out is, I think you're absolutely right on Thomas Jane, who plays the guy who has Tourette's.
Oh yeah.
It implies that Tourette's is that it's like the same thing. It's almost, there's the South Park episode.
That's what I was just thinking about. And that was like 2007.
Yeah. And they were, what they were commenting on was like, they were being subversive. They were just like, hey, by the way, Tourette's is not just screaming obscenities every five seconds. It's an actual disorder that deserves to be taken seriously. And, Shane Black plays it totally for comedy. So as you said, so out of touch. Jacob, the whole Jacob Tremblay thing, I feel so bad for that kid because, again, he's a kid. Like, he's going to do what the director tells him to do. And it makes you... Now, I'm not going to pretend like I'm an expert on, people who are on the spectrum. There's so many different ways that people on the spectrum, like, engage with the world. It's so complicated and so... you have to have such a level of nuance to portray and to write a character who is on the autistic spectrum, because there is no one, it's a spectrum. There's no one way to be on the spectrum. Some people have sensory issues. Some people don't make eye contact or things like, it's like so many different things. And to try and boil that down into one character is like almost irresponsible. And you would think that with Shane Black, like, does Shane Black think that having Asperger's just means you have to wipe your nose a lot?
Like, I mean, that's essentially like everyone's character. Like, that was that's the thing. Everyone in this movie has a defining quirk, and that was essentially the little kid's quirk is that he wipes his nose a lot and doesn't have friends.
Yeah,
and it's, I mean, and even divorced from like the ethical implications, it's just. It's really poor writing, and you can tell that they're using everything as such a surface level MacGuffin. It's just that's a good way to put it. I mean, I feel like everything in this movie was just a pile of MacGuffins that were sort of scattered around, and then it didn't really come to fruition.
None of it really matters.
Yeah, and then it's set up for a sequel, and I don't know how long we're gonna have to wait to get the second one because this one didn't do that well. It's neck and neck with the box office numbers for Predators, and that was 2010. So with inflation, that's made notably more. I mean maybe we'll need wait another 8 years, maybe we'll wait another 16. Either way, I don't think I'll necessarily be waiting for the next one.
No. Well, and that sucks because I love this franchise, and all we need, I think what it needs is just something fresh. And that's what it's always been, is like bring in something fresh. Predators is not my favorite of all of them, but it at least flipped the script a little bit and still paid its dues to the original. So I thought, if they brought back Nimrod Antal, I would not be upset. And Robert Rodriguez, I think they kind of had a handle on an end of vision for what they wanted the franchise to look like, going forward. So for me, the Predator, I think I'd maybe watch it if it were on cable, because there's some decent kills. You get some pretty cool kills. We won't have to go into it here, but like also the CGI.
I was just thinking about that. There's a
film,
especially towards the climax, there's some very under-rendered CGI that
horrifying.
And it's not in a good way. It reminded me of The Final Destination, the fourth one.
Yeah.
It, I was like, oh God, this is so, and again, it's not a camp fest. Like it tries to have a semblance of drama. It pretends to be tethered to reality, and yeah. it's so tonally inconsistent, and it's very unaware of its place in the franchise and in 2018 film as a whole. So it's just a waste.
Yeah. At least the practical effects that were there did look really good.
Yeah, sure. No, I mean, it's
Crowder looked really great.
Yeah. I mean, and again, it's like, I enjoy seeing Olivia Munn do her thing. I like Trevante Rhodes, who is adult Chiron from Moonlight. He's also in it. He's just super charismatic. So I enjoyed watching him again.
Yeah. He went for it. And
yeah,
tidbit, second, that's the second actor from Moonlight to be in a Predator film.
Oh, you're right. Mahershala Ali was in Predators.
So maybe we get young Chiron into the next one. I would not be upset if Barry Jenkins does the next Predator. I'd go apeshit.
That would be amazing. Can you imagine how good that cinematography would be? Oh.
Okay, let's pitch it. Let's do it.
Yeah, let's make a pitch.
Come on, 20th Century. Well, now Disney, 20th Century Fox / Disney. Let's get off the ground. Let's go to a movie that you really enjoyed. I loved your write up on it. Thought you really captured this film, which is going to, for the people who see it, I feel like you're either going to be like, this is fucking it. This is 2018 in a nutshell. Or you're just going to be like, this is depraved and like accomplishes nothing.
Yeah.
Assassination Nation.
Yeah. I like people listening they can't see it. I have a massive grin on my face right now. Oh, I love this movie.
You're right upset at all. It was dripping from the page in terms of like how much, you really bit into this movie and just, you're like, it's like having a nice, really rich, savory piece of pie, like, you know, it's,
yeah, and it is
really just digging into it.
It is okay. So just to give a really quick setup, this is written and directed by Sam Levinson. This is his second feature. He also happens to be Barry Levinson's son.
Damn.
Did you know that?
No, I had no idea. So he's like a little bit of royalty there.
Yeah, so he's Barry Levinson's son. This is his second feature. I didn't see his first one. And it follows four high school girls who are implicated when their small town known as Salem gets attacked by an anonymous hacker who starts leaking everyone's texts and emails. Mm-hmm. And everyone's emotional vulnerabilities are just out for the picking. And everyone just completely loses their mind. It starts off with the mayor getting hacked. People find out that he is into dressing up as a woman and hiring male escorts. And because he's super conservative, it makes him look like a hypocrite. And then he kills himself. And then the principal gets hacked. And then it gets worse and worse from there. It's a concept that is as ugly as it is absurd. And it's treated with an equal amount of honesty. But it's also very aware of itself, and it's aware of its place within the zeitgeist, and it knows that that position is largely reactionary, and so it just goes on to blow up the mundanities of suburban life from the inside out. And I think it's really fascinating to look at this movie in terms of how it positions itself within, like, both just as, you know, satire on a more, you know, traditional level, but also how it also establishes itself in the confines of a film or just media as a whole. I mean, there are some jokes in terms of where they're not necessarily breaking the fourth wall, but they're sort of brushing against it. You know, the stylization of it quickly establishes that this is a film where the characters don't necessarily live in our world. They live in like an expressionistic take of our world. Like there's a scene early on where someone like snaps their fingers and it cues a music montage and stuff like that. It's very knowing, and it's their direct inspirations. You know, they're shown watching a 70s Japanese girl gang film, and that's, you know, very much, you know, tied into the final 30 minutes, which are brutal.
Yeah, but I feel like there's some it's a movie that is proud of its style.
Yeah, and that's gonna, that I've seen a lot of people get pissed at that, because I mean, the main, this is definitely a movie where, is the type of film where people who don't like it say, well, one of the main complaints is people say, oh, it's trying way too hard, which I think is not, I don't agree, because it's a movie that's meant to replicate the internet in all of its ridiculousness. It's like if the comment section became sentient and then got access to firearms and tried to murder everyone who was not, you know, cisgender and straight and white and male. Yeah. And it's about being a woman and not dying while doing that.
Yeah.
I've also seen some people paint it as a revenge film. I also don't see that. It's more of a survival narrative. Yeah.
That's more what I would agree with that more.
Yeah, and it's deeply upsetting. It's oddly beautiful. It's hypnotic. There's a lot of it has a lot of inspiration from older films. In how it edits together scenes. I also mentioned the expressionistic lighting and a lot of seemingly non sequitur shots that are strung about to create more of a tone. There's a lot of triptych. You know, screen editing, mm-hmm. that's earlier on, and it's this beautiful synthesis of trash culture and artsiness that I just ate up, and it's a lot.
Yeah, what I really liked about it, and you know, it might be a surface level comment to make, but it's Tarantino-esque in that mashup of high and low art in a sense. And I really hate the duality of high art versus low art, because sure. I think they both add something. And like you mentioned the girl gang movies of like the 70s and stuff. I'm like, dude, watch those movies and respect the motherfucking craft, because it is those movies. Yeah. Are problematic, very of their time, but in terms of shooting action and shooting women in movies, they were really pushed the envelope in a lot of ways. It's the same way that, like, when you look at blaxploitation, mm-hmm. you have to look at it in its context of what it did in turn, not necessarily the movie itself, but like, how does blaxploitation move things forward? And you know, I feel like there's that Tarantino-esque, like, we're gonna really go for a heightened world. Mm-hmm. And go for a world that where everybody is like pretty witty and like you know, always kind of has the right moment and the right thing to say, because it knows it's a movie, and it knows that it's like it's kind of like inherently absurd, especially with the premise.
Yeah.
And it's you know, you mentioned the whole Salem thing, and you know, mm-hmm. the very on the nose sort of commentary, but fuck it, I like those kind of movies. Like Mother is a fantastic fucking movie, and yeah. One of the biggest complaints was that it's so on the nose. I'm like, yeah, that's the point. It's punk rock as fuck. Like, it's right in your face. Like,
yeah, that's the thing. I don't have a problem if something is so on the, like, if something is so on the nose, I have no problem with that. If it has enough texture and if mm-hmm. it has enough energy behind it. And this movie is bursting at the seams with energy.
Yes.
And it's, and I like, in terms of the writing, I really enjoy, like, this is another thing. People, like, it goes to the fact that a lot of people either love this movie or hate it with a passion because they think it's obnoxious. But I think I also really enjoy stylized dialogue.
Yes.
And this movie has incredibly stylized dialogue. It's the sort of thing where when characters have their moments to speak, either like to speak their minds or to stand up to someone else, they speak in monologues, you know, they speak in status updates and they speak in tweets. It's almost like everything it is the internet personified, and it's sensory overload. But it's also really bewitching to behold. And it's just so, it is so of its time, for better and for worse.
Yeah. Do you think it's a movie that people will be able to revisit a year, 5 years from now, and maybe gain some perspective, or will it just lose its edge? Because as you said, it is very of its time. Like, this is a movie that is burdened with its technology. You know, that's always a problem when it comes to revisiting movies. And like, you go back and you watch, like, I don't know, any Tom Clancy movie of like the 90s, which really doesn't date itself necessarily in terms of events, but like, it, one of the ways it dates itself is just like the comparatively like fucking primitive technology. So right. I wonder if or if like there's a movie that involves MySpace or flip phones.
Yeah,
it just gets into your subconscious. So do you think this is a movie, like, off the top of my head, like Superbad is a movie that, you know, relies on early 2000s technology, but you don't give a shit. Like, you're too enthralled with what's happening. Do you think Assassination Nation gets to that point?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's perfectly fine because also going off of that, I always look at movies as a time capsule when they came out. Mm-hmm. This is so of its time that whether or not it ages, that's beside the point.
Yeah, it's irrelevant.
Yeah, because it came out now. It's reflective of now. And the now of when it came out is 2018. But even if it didn't age wonderfully, which I'm sure it won't, nothing does, it establishes its own world incredibly quickly and effectively. And it uses a lot of, you know, baseline American iconography to make it, to establish its world, both in terms of, you know, true emotion, and also in terms of irony. So alongside all the, you know, social media and phones and sexting, you also have things like American flags, and you have a lot of colonial houses and you know, perfect little white blonde families and stuff like that. It's a lot of stuff that's timeless, but it also, it's, you know, repackaged into something that works perfectly for this time. Obviously not perfectly. I think that there are definitely some brief moments where I became too aware, mm-hmm, of that it was talking to me. But I didn't really mind because I was so on board with it. And there's also these actors do some really great work here. A lot of them are relatively unknown. I would say one of the most known people in the movie is Joel McHale. He has a supporting role as I'm not going to get into that. He is one of the more known people, but some of the younger people in the movie who play the four young women, I want to give them credit. One of them is Odessa Young, who is a pretty unknown Australian actor. She's great as the sort of lead girl, Lily. And then there's Abra, who is like an underground, like, trip hop pop artist, mm-hmm, in real life. And then there's Suki Waterhouse, who's done a couple stuff. She was in The Bad Batch last year. And then Hari Neff, who I had never seen before, but she's so charismatic, and I really want her to get a lot of work out of this.
I think she will.
She's so charismatic in this, and I absolutely just fell in love with her. It's also nice to see a movie, you know, cast a trans person in a trans role. And the movie does some really great work with implementing people's personal identities into who their characters are, but not making it their defining traits. Because all of these things have to do with how they interact with the world around them. And the movie makes that increasingly clear as the film goes on. But they're never tokenized. They're just there.
Yeah. It's a movie that, you know, I hope it stays polarizing, because polarizing movies are more fun to talk about.
Yeah, and I'm really curious to see how this plays out in the next couple months or years, just because it's Neon, the distributor, bought this at Sundance for $10 million, which blows my mind.
Yeah.
That they paid $10 million for this, because I don't think anyone would ever expect this to be financially successful. I mean, it has been out for 2 weeks now, and it's made $1.7 million nationwide. I mean, they also decided to open it nationwide, and it had one of the worst openings for a nationwide release of the year.
Yeah. And so I think with the purchase of $10 million, companies like Neon... They as a relatively young distribution house,
mm-hmm.
They're trying to find their footing in terms of what does a Neon movie mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, because let's look at their, you know, main competitor, A24.
Yeah.
Everybody knows what an A24 movie means. Like,
mm-hmm.
And even people that don't give a fuck about like art, you know, I guess, quote unquote art house,
mm-hmm.
it's, A24 has really put their mark on the indie with a capital I sort of market.
Yeah.
And when people see that, they're like, oh, especially now that they, you know, they're looking at, they've got Oscar noms, they've got so much shit.
They got Oscar wins. They got a best picture win with Moonlight.
Yeah. They've got it all now. So I think Neon is going for the what is the Neon aesthetic, and it seems to be
Neon aesthetic.
Yeah,
I mean, a lot of their movies are very neon. They're not lying about that with Bad Batch and Ingrid Goes West and Revenge
I think they're doing a lot better. Mm-hmm. I think they're getting to that point. I think Neon. That's they were started by. The dude behind Alamo Drafthouse, right?
Yeah, Tim League, who's also a kind of a trash person. I hate everyone. Jeez. yeah, he's there's. If you want to be angry, Google him and his scandal. It was co-founded, I believe, by Tim League, who is behind Alamo Drafthouse, and their first one of their they really. First came on the scene just last year with they had Colossal, they had
I
like Colossal. They had The Bad Batch, which disappointed me, but then they also had some other stuff. They had Risk, which was the Julian Assange documentary. They had I, Tonya last year, they had Ingrid Goes West, which was one of my favorites of last year. And so I think they're getting a better foothold on what they're doing.
Yeah, they're getting there. They're just
being able to market that. I mean, they also had Revenge earlier this year, which is great.
Yeah.
That is brutal, but that also makes for a wonderful double feature with this movie.
Yeah, and maybe that's where Neon is going to mm-hmm. be the almost the B movie little sister to A24, which mm-hmm. is good for me because I'm a person that when it comes to movies, I have this strange like fetish for cruelty. Like if people are going to be cruel, they might as well do it on like in a movie where no one's actually getting hurt.
Oh, sure.
Like, and I find film to be a fantastic way to explore those kind of socially unacceptable parts of our personality. And that's why this movie works so well, is because that's exactly what this is. This is like, let's hold up the mirror and see how fucking sickening people can be. And it doesn't exclude the main characters either, because parts of them are just horrible.
Skeletons.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of double features, I would also watch this with True Romance. Which is, I think, another movie about cruel people, but you know, you latch onto the people who are the least cruel and who are doing what they do to just kind of get by. They're responding to cruelty and anger and violence, not so much generating it in some ways. But I want to end the discussion on Assassination Nation with the line, and it's in the trailer as well, where they're all the girls are sitting around and they're talking about like the concept of privacy, and God, what's the line? I had it in my head for so long because we carried the trailer for like 4 weeks in this theater.
Oh, and was it like, with Bella Thorne?
Yeah, we've got a super gross porn history.
Yeah, it's like I have like a super gross porn history, like a million nudes. like life-altering shit talk about everyone at this school.
That line specifically cracks me up every time because it's so true. Like, you know, people, even when you and I were in high school, roughly about the same time, you know, like the late 2000s, early 2010s.
Mm-hmm.
You knew that person, like you knew the people who had life altering shit talk. And it's just so funny to hear that in a movie. I'm like, I really relate to this. This is great.
I also like one more thing. I also, think it's funny. A lot of comparisons I've been seeing are to The Purge, which I think this is what The Purge tried to do. And it's this second half of this movie is, oh my God, it's bonkers. But another comparison that I also have made is to Heathers, just in the bitchiness and the verbal gymnastics that it has and the sharpness. But a thing I feel like a lot of people aren't picking up on is the fact that unlike Heathers or a lot of these teen movies, there isn't a cattiness alongside, like in between the female leads. Like they fight for themselves and they fight for their friends. They're not turning on each other. You know, it's, I was rooting for them and I mean, I've seen it twice now. I absolutely loved it.
It's a little bit like Thoroughbreds in that sense.
Oh yeah. Oh, I love Thoroughbreds. Yeah.
That was a movie that took me at least three watches to really get. I was like, sidebar, like that was a movie that was, I feel like it's really popular right now to market things as the next Heathers. Like,
I've been noticing a lot of movies have just been ilking Heathers like crazy.
Yeah, they're having, like, Heathers is having a marketing renaissance right now, which is really strange.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, dude, watching Thoroughbreds, I'm like, no, this is, it's like Heathers insofar as, like, there's teens and they kill somebody.
Yeah.
Like, but that's not what Heathers is. Like, Assassination Nation is, like you said, more Heathers.
Yeah.
In that sense, where it's that wittiness and everything like that. We'll jump over to quickly Mandy, which is a movie that people are going pretty gaga over, at least visually. People are like, this is a crazy movie. And also, I feel like Nick Cage, are we back? Is Nick Cage back?
I feel like that kind of almost happened with Kick-Ass in 2010.
I know, because he was so good in it.
Lead to anything else. I think it's funny, Mandy, a lot of people are talking about it in terms of like, oh, Nicolas Cage goes batshit crazy. And that's really not until the last half hour of this 2-hour movie.
Yeah.
And for a lot of it, he's not in it, or it's comparatively subdued to what he usually does. But Panos Cosmatos, the director, is very much interested in making another, you know, trip art, neon coded, hallucinatory sort of just experience as opposed to an actual narrative film. And I really admire how it so quickly establishes, you know, if you're not going to like this movie, you're going to know in the first 20 minutes, maybe first 15. And I really admire that it doesn't pretend to be more than it is, which is almost like an art installation of a film. it appeals to a very specific subset of people. And if you're part of it, awesome. You're going to be all for it. If you're not, I mean, you can't, but you still can't dismiss the artistry of it. It's kind of two movies, which I also don't think a lot of people will be expecting, just in terms of it, the first hour specifically is very slow. But I was in awe of the artistry. It's very hypnotic. It's that sort of like Argento pastiche sort of stuff like that I completely eat up. But then once it actually goes nutty, about, you know, 2/3 of the way in, it's the kind of thing that people were more or less looking forward to.
Yeah, I feel like it was one of those movies that may have been marketed a little bit heavy on one aspect.
Mm-hmm.
It reminded me a little bit of It Comes at Night, where people went in thinking they were just going to get a Nicolas Cage screaming fuckfest, and that's like largely not the movie, which is fine. I was okay with that. But I knew some people that were expecting a little bit more of, you know, Nicolas Cage losing his shit. If you want that, there is a movie out there. There's multiple, but if you want a recent Nick Cage movie where he just goes batshit, there's Mom and Dad,
mm-hmm.
which I think was a really fun one. I was like, this is dope. It's at least interesting, and Selma Blair's in it. But yeah, Mandy, I like what you said about the broad strokes of Argento. There's that, and I could definitely see this director moving into something more like Gaspar Noé, or however you say that guy's name.
Yeah, I could see that.
Or like Enter the Void, where it's like, don't worry about the fucking narrative. Like, it's not really that important. Like, just go on this crazy trip.
Yeah.
I liked Mandy. I thought it was, I had to rent it at home. I had to like,
oh yeah. Cause I saw it at a midnight showing at the Music Box in their smaller theater. And I was just like, oh, I need to just see this damn thing. Cause it's already been out for 2 weeks. And I missed it at every turn. I missed it at Cannes. And then I didn't see it when it came out for like 2 weeks here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But I mean, also my main takeaway for it has to do again with, you know, the technical artistry of it. I really love how it bridges the gap between, you know, like art house and grindhouse. There's a really subtle but consistent, you know, bridging the gap between those two aesthetics. But mainly in terms of its color choices, almost everything is like a primary color scheme. And so you have a lot of red for rage, a lot of blue for intimacy, and then a lot of yellow to kind of tie it down to the ground.
Yeah.
And that's there are some scenes that get a bunch of splashes of green, and maybe that is for the most part as far away from the primary color scheme as you'll go. But it's also really like, I mean, it's beautiful aesthetically, but it's also really well done in how it, like the pagan subcultures that it's, you know, heavy metal inspirations, you know, derive from to an extent. It also has its own sense of alchemy just in the simplicity of its visuals.
Yeah.
And that creates something that is also just sort of breathtaking at points, and it's simplistic. And it's really hypnotic, and I really, really enjoyed it for the first hour or so. I mean, it did start to lose me once it started to go into some of the more nutty aspects of it. I feel like it didn't necessarily just choose a lane in terms of how silly it wanted to be. There are like some bursts of, you know, batshit nuttiness.
Yeah.
But I feel like at points they don't milk it as much as they could have. So it kind of dilutes both edges of the sword in that way.
It's a very hype film. Like,
yeah.
The hype surrounding it is almost more fascinating at times than the movie itself. But I think it's pretty solid. I was really glad to see it. And I'm really glad that Nick Cage is still willing to do those sorts of roles. And I just find him to be a fucking fascinating person. Like,
yeah,
he did a GQ thing for like on YouTube where he talked about all his roles. That guy, that guy goes fucking deep. Like he's not an idiot. Like people think
he's crazy not.
Or stupid or something. And I'm just like, no, this guy is a fucking artist.
Oh, he obviously knows what he's doing. And that's what I'm also sure that he always knew what he was doing all along, but it's especially fascinating to watch his career take this turn where he is point blank, you know, self-referential. But I mean, it also shows that self-referentialness doesn't have to be making everything a camp fest. I mean, there is genuine emotion to his performance here, and I do think it's admirable. I mean, there are also moments where, you could make a couple really fun gifs of his just crazy face. There's like one, there's one scene where he like, I think it's like he stabs someone and then there's like a shard of glass and he like does an entire line of cocaine off of the shard of glass and then makes like a face.
Yeah.
And I was, and everyone in the theater just went, yeah.
Fuck
yeah, dude. Like, it's that sort of stuff, but it still works.
The music box viewing audience at midnight, you know exactly, yeah, it's exactly who they are.
It was that, and also when I went in there, in the main theater, they were showing the midnight screening of The Room. So I'm sure entire building was just about to implode.
But a lot of dudes with beards.
Yeah, I was one of them.
No, ain't nothing wrong with that. All right, we're going to have to go into a little bit of a lightning round here. So I'll just name one of these movies. You give me maybe like two sentences about it and, sure, and whether or not you recommend it. White Boy Rick.
I really enjoyed the there's a technical proficiency that I really like about this in terms of, it has a very gritty, tactile color scheme. Everyone in this movie just feels so cold and it feels dirty and immersive. The performances are typically well done. It's nice to see Belle Powley from Diary of a Teenage Girl get more work. I wish her career was more out there than it is, because she is fantastic. But it doesn't seem entirely educated or up to date with the themes it's trying to touch on, such as the criminal justice system or white privilege. Just sort of tosses those into the forefront and then moves on. So it feels kind of shallow. It feels.
Do we wait for it on Redbox or something?
Yeah, I mean, if you're interested in that sort of thing and a odd true crime story, then you could watch it eventually, but it's also something you could just read about.
Yeah, don't necessarily need to rush out to the theater to see White Boy Rick.
No.
Let's see. The House with a Clock in Its Walls. From the director of Cabin Fever.
Yeah, the director of Hostel and the Death Wish remake. It's so odd. It's funny also, when they marketed this, I had no idea that he directed this until like the week before it came out.
Oh, you know, they were playing it down because.
Oh, like, I know. And I was like,
it was a Death Wish.
I know. And then someone's like, oh, yeah, it's Eli Roth. And I was like, that Eli Roth?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I actually, like, I know you liked this a lot more than I did. For a while, I thought it was okay, but I also was kind of disappointed just in terms of Eli Roth. I still feel like just doesn't know how to work with his actors. So it has Jack Black doing his Jack Blackness, which is nice, but it's also indistinguishable from his previous work. It has a lot of stiff stiff child acting, which is unfortunate because the main kid here makes for a likable protagonist. It's just that he's very aware that he's acting.
Yeah.
And same with also Sonny Soljak, who plays like the kid who wants to be friends with. He was in Killing of a Sacred Deer and he's going to be in mid-90s later this year. He also, I wasn't there for it. But I mean, the main thing is it tries to go for that sort of,
Spielberg,
like 80s heyday Amblin Entertainment stuff. Mm-hmm. But it feels, I felt like it was closer to the mid 2000s and it's like reliance on shoddy CG and, you know, offbeat, you know, period detail that doesn't really mesh all that well. It felt kind of shoddy.
I was okay with it. I went in expecting nothing special and got something that was like, I don't know, slightly better than the average children's movie. Compared to like, I don't know, so many crappy kids movies I've seen this year, and I'm kind of like shocked at how many kids movies I've seen, period. I thought it was all right. I thought it was, you could take your kids to it and they'd probably enjoy it and be like, oh, it's so wacky. Oh, Jack Black. What's he doing? Like all that kind of stuff. I think maybe Eli Roth has to atone for some of his sins in terms of directing a truly socially damaging version of Death Wish.
Yeah, that was
like, just really, really rude and ill-timed.
Yeah.
Fahrenheit 11/9, coming from everybody's favorite provocateur documentarian.
Yeah, I mean, whether or not you hate him, Michael Moore is back. Whether you love him or hate him, I'm not even going to try to be objective with this because I agree with his politics almost to a T. As a person, he irks me. I think he's kind of I have several issues with him as a person, but I mean, in Fahrenheit 11/9 is a very well-made documentary in terms of it is a page turner of a documentary, even though it is all of 2 hours, and it is frustrating in that it exhibits his usual issues as a filmmaker, mostly in terms of he has a lot of, you know, ideas that he's going for that are pretty scattershot, but they're especially frustrating because he could have easily rearranged all of his topics to make for a more cohesive narrative.
Right.
And it's also especially kind of obnoxious because these are all the issues that he has made. These are all the problems that he's had in the past. And so it's either a lack of self-awareness or like a resistance towards growing as a filmmaker. But either way,
I'd say the latter. When literally the best documentary you ever made was the first documentary you ever made, mm-hmm. like,
yeah,
he probably sees no reason to change his tactics. I mean, even I remember when Fahrenheit 9/11 came out, and what was the other one where he like takes over the world? What it was like?
Where to Invade Next? Sicko?
Yeah, Where to Invade Next? Yeah,
yeah.
I was just like, wow, these are both visually and narratively almost exactly the same as Bowling for Columbine, which is a movie that like probably is taught in documentary classes just as like a moment for the documentary genre, because he really brought it to the people. He was just like, hey, it's not all fucking Richard Attenborough describing what meerkats are doing. It's like we can do something really socially salient.
And
I would argue that 2018, which I think has been a banner year for documentary filmmaking, you can trace all those influences and storytelling styles back to Bowling for Columbine and what it did in 1999, 2000, like cracked open people's interest for documentaries and this thirst for people to watch documentary film and be legitimately interested and use all these kind of more traditional narrative storytelling techniques that you see in regular Hollywood movies, but now it's actually telling you a true story and telling you some certain facts. When it comes to so his voice in this is basically the same as it's ever been.
But it's also just as intriguing, and it's so entertaining to watch. And it is, despite the fact that it has structural issues, it's very well paced. I mean, it is all 2 hours. I'm pretty sure it's over 2 hours. But it's a page turner of a documentary, and it's typically impassioned. A lot of genuinely fascinating points that a lot of people make the, you know, Trump compared to Hitler, a lot of people compare Trump to Hitler. This one does that too, but it also makes a lot more points that are a lot more in depth. And it's, on top of that, I think it's, he does also have a little bit more of an even ground in terms of the people that he's shitting on. I mean, like, no one gets away from this unscathed. He goes after Hillary. He goes after the DNC. He goes after Trump. He goes after Rick Snyder. He goes after a ton of people with equal aplomb, and that sort of just like scorched earth. Let's start everything again is refreshing and cathartic.
Yeah. I like Michael. I mean, again, as a filmmaker, we have to, I'm definitely a person that's just like, I can remove myself from a person's work and their personality and like their actions necessary, just by necessity. Otherwise, you're basically not going to be able to watch movies anymore because a lot of filmmakers are just bastards. They're just fucking assholes. I could never watch Vertigo again because Alfred Hitchcock was a manipulative piece of shit. But I'm glad that he's still relatively in the game. I just feel like so many people have this opinion of him as just being like a shit stirrer that they don't want to watch it and they don't even want to engage with it. And like, I feel like some people would look at him as almost a liberal Ben Shapiro in a sense. And I know that's like a little bit of a stretch, but it's that kind of shit stirrer. I know more than you. I'm the fucking man. But like Michael Moore, he's put in a lot more time, and he knows exactly what he's about. And I don't think he's the type of person that would, if someone were to challenge him and someone were to be like, you know, I didn't like your movie, he'd probably be like, yeah, dude, that's fine. Like,
yeah,
I really don't care. I got my message out there. It's just a medium for him.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's see. Is there somewhere we want to end? You know, I'm really curious because I haven't seen this one. The Sisters Brothers, coming from Joaquin Phoenix, John C. Reilly, Western.
Yeah. So this is, I'm probably going to butcher this name, Jacques Odiard, who did Rust and Bone. This is, well, first of all, I want to point out that if you're going to go see this based on the trailers, rethink that. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. You should see it. I like it. But these are some of the most misleading trailers in recent memory, just in terms of they build it as a snappy, self-aware, comedic Western. This is a slow burn, and it is very slow. It is pacing, you know, reminiscent of the, you know, the 40s and 50s Westerns, that very stoic, reserved, like has moments of riot, you know, candor that sort of breaks apart the, you know, the desert that it finds itself in. But either way, it is very slow. A lot of times it's kind of hypnotic. But this is something with a lot of very sharp characterizations. It's, you know, it's very much rooted in the tropes of the Western genre, but instead of treating them as sort of like a lot of, you know, reflective genre pieces, which I feel like to an extent you could classify this as a reflective genre piece. Unlike a lot of those movies, this treats its tropes as like a, like sufficient task or sufficient task, in terms of just a lot of, you know, all of its characters are doing things that will never be entirely fulfilled. It has almost this balance between nihilism and redemption. It's oddly touching, but it also, I don't think it completely sticks the landing. It becomes a little bit pedantic just in terms of how quickly its tone shifts. But it's really well shot. It was shot by Benoit Debye, who shot things like Spring Breakers and Enter the Void. This is a lot more tethered to reality work for the cinematographer, but you know, there's a lot of evocative imagery here that is grounded by the intimacy of its characters. So it's, you know, it's a fascinating watch. I don't think it lands every single mark, but it's definitely something to check out.
All right. Matt Cipolla.
Yay.
He's a film critic at large. Can't stop him. Remind us all where we can find some of your reviews and where we can follow you on social media.
Yeah, so you can find some reviews on filmmonthly.com, and then you can find me on Twitter at Cipolla Matt. That's just Cipolla Matt. And then I'm also on Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd, all those things. Yeah, I'm also going to be plugging along some other stuff. I have some other things that'll be posted on other outlets within the month. So keep an eye out on those. I'll be plugging those on the internet.
Fantastic. Well, we'll make sure to keep up with you. And I want to leave this. When it comes to October, I love to challenge myself. I watch 31 horror movies, one for each day. Sometimes I have to do double features to catch up and everything. Are there any horror films that you are excited to see this month, or are you going to revisit this month?
Well, I know I'm going to watch all the Scream movies again because I just love all the Scream movies.
Scream 4 is crazy.
Yeah, I really...
I did not see that movie when it came out, and I know it's on Netflix, right? I don't know when it came on to Netflix, but I saw it, and I was just like, oh, shit, I never saw this. The first... I think we've talked about this before. The first, like, 5 to 10 minutes of that movie are just fucking insane. Like,
I couldn't believe it. I love that. Also, there's the music box... Anyone who knows me knows that I will forever stand up for Jennifer's Body. underrated classic of our time. I unironically love this movie. The music box is playing it on 35mm at midnight on October 19th and 20th. So unless you want to be a loser and not see the best... Yeah, I mean, unless you don't want to see the best Diablo Cody script that she wrote, you should totally check that out.
This is before Tully, of course. It is before Tully.
Yeah, this is after her Juno. After she won an Academy Award for Juno, she made the movie about Megan Fox as a succubus killing boys. It's so good.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, Matt. We'll talk to you real soon. This has been No Coast Cinema here on WGN Plus. We're your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago, and we will catch you all very soon.